On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Jensen and Holes Winter Distractions. We are continuing to speak with some of our favorite people in the true crime world, and today is no different. We are speaking to one of the people who helped shape the world of profiling.
Dr. Ann Burgess, the real-life forensic psychiatric nurse that Wendy Carr in Mindhunters is based on, began her work studying rape and sexual assaults. Once called in to help the FBI's behavioral science unit, she spent over two decades interviewing serial killers, rapists, kidnappers, as well as their victims. We're going to talk to her and her co-author, Stephen Constantine, about their new book, A Killer by Design, Murders, Mindhunters, and My Quest to Decipher the Criminal Mind. Hello, Dr. Burgess and Stephen. How are you?
Good.
Hello, good to be here.
Fantastic.
Good to be here.
So, Dr. Burgess, you are such a pioneer in the realm of behavioral sciences. So many of the members of the Murder Squad, our listeners, want to be you. Like they all, you know, as soon as they see authors, they've seen people on TV. But I think as soon as they all watched Mindhunters and they saw Wendy Carr, they were just like, that's it. That's what I want. So we're going to get to the book in a moment. But how has your life changed since the show came out?
Well, first of all, I didn't know the show was coming out. I mean, I had talked with John Douglas over the years and it was on, it was off. And so I wasn't really paying too much attention until all of a sudden I started getting these calls from other countries. Iceland called, Greece called, Israel called, UK called. And it was all about this Mindhunter and this Dr. Wendy Carr. So I thought I better start looking at it. And that's how I actually found out about it. And then, of course, I got back to John and there had been a lot of logistic problems, let's say, with his and negotiations between Netflix and his book and so forth. So that's how I came to know it.
So it was already in the can, it had already been shot. So
yeah.
When you started watching it, what was that like? How surreal was it? And what were some of the things that they got definitely right and some of the things that actually were a little bit, you know, author's license?
They got the cases right. Well, of course, they should have because they had the content. John's book had about the offenders. And what they didn't get right, which I thought was a way off, was the backgrounds of the three of us, of John, Bob Ressler, and myself. They really kind of, I guess, tried to Hollywood it and make it more interesting than what we really were like. And that, I think, was not helpful for the book. I really don't think they really on the second season seemed to get really focusing more on the backgrounds of the three characters rather than on the cases themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, for many of our listeners, they may not realize that show was actually based on this academic study, Sexual Homicide Patterns and Motives, in which Dr. Burgess, John Douglas, and Bob Ressler were the authors of. And, you know, for me, you know, my parents actually gave me this book for my 25th birthday, almost 30 years ago. And I have to say, Dr. Burgess, it's such an honor to be able to talk to you because this study is what basically caused me to pursue the path of my career that I did. So I thank you, you know, in order to be able to give me sort of a direction. And I also think it's important to point out is that you've been involved, you know, obviously this was a study of offenders, but you've been involved in studying victims of sexual assault. And you started out as it was a forensic psychiatric nurse. So you're dealing with victims after they've been traumatized by sexual assault.
Right, right. Well, the other thing I wanted to do also is speak for the victim that didn't survive. And I felt that was really important because they could say or do anything about the character of the victim. And I felt that wasn't very fair. And so I really like the opportunity to be able to add from a more feminist or a more victim-oriented view about the victims and how they died.
Yeah, and your book, that's what you are trying to do, is trying to portray not only, you know, going back over your career, but also giving those victims a voice.
Right. Because many people are very interested in the killer or the offender or whatever, but they don't seem to be that interested in the victim. Mm-hmm. And I think that that equation needs to be better balanced. And that's what I tried to do and what Stephen and I tried to do in the Killer by Design book.
Yeah. You actually started out, like, one of your first papers that you co-wrote was The Rape Victim in the Emergency Ward.
That's
in,
right.
In 1973. And this is when, I mean, we saw how, particularly as we were going back, looking at over the Golden State Killer and how rape victims, which obviously Paul was involved in, but not at that time, how rape and rape victims were dealt with pre-1980, you know, where it wasn't deemed, you know, in a lot of places, wasn't even deemed to be a serious crime. But I mean, that's pretty groundbreaking to write something in 73 focusing on the victim of a sexual assault like that. And then that was the thing that got you getting loud with that is the thing that got the FBI to notice you, right?
That's what did it. That's what did it was another nurse that told Roy Hazelwood when he was out there doing a hostage negotiation lecture for the LAPD. And he kind of was moaning and saying, oh, we got this new assignment. He's going to have to talk about rape investigation. And one of the officers there was a juvenile, worked juveniles, and it was Rita Connect. She also was a nurse. And on weekends, to keep her clinical skills up, she would go to the, she'd work the emergency room. And this one particular weekend, she happened to pick up the American Journal of Nursing and read it. The article was in there. Hmm. So she said to Roy, she said, why don't you check out this? There's a nurse out on the East Coast. Why don't you check her out? And that's what actually happened. He did. He called me and invited me down to lecture on rape investigation.
When you first meet Robert Ressler and John Douglas, what was that like? And what did you see that, how did you initially think it was going to go when they're just like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start, you know, interviewing people, interviewing serial killers, interviewing rapists, trying to get inside the criminal mind. What were you thinking about the dynamic and how that was going to work between you three?
Well, I wasn't thinking about that at the time. I did meet them. And what they were doing was just kind of whenever they had some free time on a road school, is they would go to the local prison and just talk to prisoners. And that was because Bob Ressler said, how can I teach criminology if I haven't even talked to a criminal? It's not that they hadn't talked to a criminal, but they did the investigation. They come at a case in a very different way than any interviewing. So he really wanted the experience. So that was really important. But at the same time, William Webster, who was now new director of the FBI, had said, the FBI Academy is our academic arm, and we need to be doing research. That's what academics do. And so he had said, put the word out that at the Academy, they better be doing some research. So Ressler and Douglas got together and thought about this criminal personality project. And I was there at the time, and that's how it all really started. They needed someone to do the methodology part. Because they weren't, that was nothing they had majored in college or anything. So I was really brought in from that standpoint of trying to get some structure, trying to get it. So it really turned out to be a research project.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of my career, I was focused on cold cases, notably out of the late 60s into the 1970s. And, you know, I saw how law enforcement did treat victims of sexual assault. And I know today, because I've been told, is that there's numerous law enforcement investigators, sexual assault investigators, homicide investigators that listen to this podcast. If you were to give somebody some advice in terms of how to deal with a victim, or as we know them today, a survivor of sexual assault, are there any nuggets of wisdom that you can pass on to those that are listening?
Oh, I think there are. Well, that's something Roy Hazelwood and I did. We did five different editions of Rape Investigation from a practical standpoint. Roy was very practical. So in that, tried to use the examples that Roy had run across, and certainly those that I had, to how do you interview? So we talked about how do you interview a victim? What are some of the myths? How can you dispel those? What should police officers look for? What is evidence? You know, just kind of ran through the basics 101. And we had to start with them, actually started the, for the first couple of editions, had to just start with myths because that's where they were at.
Yeah.
You know, it was so easy to blame the victim or to say she shouldn't have been walking out at night at that hour or that her clothes were too provocative or things like that. That's really where many, not only police officers were, but prosecutors and judges were.
Yeah. No, and so that's actually a good point. And now for those studies or thesis that you guys put out, was that in any particular journal or any particular publication where we can point people to get that information?
Well, one of the journals that we published in was the LAB, the Law Enforcement Bulletin, because that really was their journal or law enforcement's journal. But Webster had made the good point that it needed to go out to other journals and we needed to get the information out of what law enforcement was doing. And so that's where we started putting some of the material into American Journal of Psychiatry, which is considered a premier journal in their field. Certainly put a lot into nursing, put others into criminal justice journals. So we did quite a bit of publishing, and that, of course, all moved toward the ultimate book from the project, which was what you held up earlier as a sexual homicide. That was the actual research data from 36 killers.
Right.
But we published, I certainly helped them publish in their own journals, too.
Okay. Now, when you were working, you said you worked on the methodology, so it wasn't just, same types of questions for each one, and then how you're going to compile them. Was there anything that surprised you from a specific killer as these answers were coming in and you're looking at them going, wow?
Oh, there was a lot that surprised me because nobody had ever really interviewed these people, so that much of the data were very, very interesting as far as I was concerned, and how the offenders talked, how the killers talked about basic information, because the agents had to follow a protocol. We had a questionnaire. We had 100 and, I don't know, Stephen probably knows, but 157 page questionnaire that had to be filled out. And I think the other important thing is that it was compared with the records. The agents reviewed all of the records before they went in to talk with an offender or an inmate at that time, because they didn't want the offender to embellish anything or try to put it over on them or manipulate them, that kind of thing. They were very much aware of that aspect of the inmate. So they could, I mean, I remember with David Berkowitz when he was talking about the dog, and the dog was sending him messages and so forth. And I remember Douglas, a wrestler, just said, that's just not, well, they used other colorful language, but essentially said, that's not true, David. And once David or Berkowitz realized that, he started talking very differently, and they felt that they are getting more information from them.
Yeah. Now, you've got a book, A Killer by Design. You know, I was able to get an early release of it, and it's going to become a permanent fixture on my bookshelf. But you have multiple cases that you highlight in this book, you know, based on, you know, your perspective and your experience in doing it. And I'm going to let Billy kind of start, you know, marching through this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the first case is very interesting to me, and I'll let you know once kind of Billy segues into it.
Yeah. So first one I want to talk about is the Bernadette Prati case from 1984 in California. Can you walk us through that case and then what struck you about it to have this being one of the ones that you wanted to focus on in the book?
It was an important case. It was at a time when it was very important to counter some of the pushback that the agents were getting on this profiling. So it was kind of a perfect case to... It hadn't been solved for 6 months. It was a female on female. Victim was a juvenile, I don't know, 15, 16 years old. And it was very the local officers weren't able to put much together on it. And so they called the FBI, and Rod Walker was one of the agents. He was, I think he was what we call a third generation profiler, but these were all Douglas trained profilers, which is really important to know who has trained the profiler. I think that's why they get so many different kinds of cases or profiling cases. So Ron went in and they went over it. Case came in and we were all around the table, typical fashion where they had the crime scenes and who did what and so forth. So that part came up with what we felt or what the agents felt was a good profile. They felt, and the book essentially goes into that. Then what became important is a few months later, they had already sent their profile in. And this was a case where one of their key suspects had passed the polygraph. So this was important that they talk with the polygrapher and find out more about that. So that becomes kind of a side issue. And Ron Walker was really quite instrumental in talking with the other Ron, who actually did they went back in and did another polygraph and essentially were able to get the suspect, the young teenager actually, to confess.
Yeah. So Bernadette was she was a classmate of a girl named Kristen. She lures her out of the house, saying that there's some sort of an initiation to a social club. Then they have a confrontation. And then I believe that Bernadette kills her on the way home.
Well, what happened is there was about a 30-minute delay in which they're in the car. Two females are in the car. And actually, Bernadette is trying to, really wants to get to the party that she knew Kristen had been invited to. That was her ultimate goal. And she had made up this, as you just said, this rather fantastic story that they were going to go to the Bobbage Club. So something happened in the car, obviously, because then Kristen gets out and Bernadette gets out and follows her. And that's where she has a knife. Always was important to know where that knife came from, and stabs her right on the lawn in front of the neighbor's house. And so it's seen, people see it, and yet they knew the car. It was an orange Pinto. They knew a car, and yet they couldn't put it together. So from the agent's standpoint, this was really important to get it solved. Mm-hmm. Because it had created such a problem in the community, as you can imagine.
Yeah, you know,
who had killed this young girl.
In this case, actually, it was before my time, but it occurred in my jurisdiction. This was in Orinda, California, Miramonte High School. Yeah. And, you know, if I remember correct, and you guys correct me, but the offender was 17 years old. She was a cheerleader. And there was some sort of jealousy factor between Bernadette and Kristen. So this is kind of important, you know, and I think, you know, it's an unusual case because here you have female on female, you know, but it oftentimes when you see a female offender, it's not the fantasy motivated types of crimes, but there's other types of motivations that drive women to kill. And maybe if you can expound upon that, I'd be fascinated to hear that.
Well, there always was a question of whether this was intentional or whether this was meant to scare her more, or what was going on, if you will, in Bernadette's mind. But clearly, if she felt that Kristen was going to say something negative about her, which I think was what the fear was, that she'd be called weird or whatever, that could have been. But how, because there never was a trial, it was a plea, but there wasn't a trial. So you didn't have the opportunity to get a lot of information. Certainly the FBI polygrapher got the information because he spent 3 hours with her. Yeah. But that never came into the information that we had.
Yeah.
I don't know. Stephen might have some other perspective on it, right, Stephen?
Yeah, I would just add that one of the reasons we wanted to put that case into the book was when Dr. Burgess originally started working with the BSU, and doing the serial killer study she was working on, you know, the demographics of that group of killers were all the same. They were all white men of a similar age, fairly similar backgrounds. And one of the things that Dr. Burgess always thought was important was looking around the room at the BSU and noticing who wasn't there and who didn't have a voice, because, you know, a big part of profiling is being able to think your way into an offender's head. And if an offender doesn't look like you, you might need somebody in that room that has a similar look, a similar background, and that can have an easier time thinking their way into that offender's head and can communicate that to the rest of the group. And, you know, being the first woman, the only woman who was often in these conversations, Dr. Burgess felt it was important to have other voices there as well.
Yeah, a true collaboration. Yeah.
Right. And that was one thing that did come out is I remember Bob Russer saying, well, where did she go? Where did this killer go, so to speak? And because I felt that we had really figured out quite a bit of it. And I said, I bet she went home, because she would go to a place where she was safe and where she felt protected. She certainly wouldn't go run away or something like that. And so they realized that. And that's why the car became so important, because that's the one thing that they knew that she had left in. So that helped too.
Right.
Finding the car. Yeah.
So another case that you focused on with a living victim was the Opal Horton case. Can you walk us through that one a little bit?
Yes. That was a case of two little girls about the same age, 7 and 8. And they were just, it was a Sunday, and they were out around noontime, just riding their little bikes in the area, which they knew. The school was there. They knew the principal. They knew some of the kids. And all of a sudden, this blue car stopped kind of like in the middle of the road and asked directions, but had a low voice. So the little girls had to come over closer. That was his lure to get her over. And he grabbed a little Opal, threw her in the car first, and then went after the second girl, which was Missy Ackerman. Opal quickly realized that there was no car handle on the passenger side. And so she, while he's going after the other little girl, she jumps out of the car and runs behind this John Deere big machinery. And that's how she was able to escape. I never forget one of the things that when I got into helping her tell us more about the assailant is she said the last thing that she knew was her little friend's little face in the back of the window with her crying for her, calling Opal. And that must have been, I'm sure that is something that just really haunted her. But we were able to get enough information to get a fairly good picture. We had an artist, the police artist, come to get a picture of the assailant. And she had pretty good memory about the car, even though she was only, 7, 8 years old. So that was important of how, and everybody had forgotten her. It had only been 11 days since the kidnapping, and nobody had even paid attention that she hadn't eaten, that she was still scared, that she wouldn't go around near windows. She was afraid she was going to be grabbed. So all of the trauma symptoms that she had, luckily, I was able to, in the drawings, get some of that information out. I think she has, in recent years, testified in, I think there was a civil suit. Opal is now obviously in her 30s, I think, 30s, 40s.
Yeah. Right. And they were able to catch the guy, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. And he had murdered a nurse just before that. And it was interesting. She talked about, she said he had whiskers on his face. So it was a Sunday. So they felt that maybe this was a long weekend. Maybe he had been drinking or taking drugs. It was somebody that was kind of disheveled. And actually a police officer had stopped him only about 30 minutes after the abduction. And it said that he checked the car. I can't believe that he checked it that thoroughly, because the little girl would have been in the back seat under a blanket. I think that's how he had thrown her into the back seat and put a blanket over her. So if only he had, and he hadn't, I don't think he had heard about the abduction, but that was always the tough thing of how to get the word out of how fast these killers kill, that you've got to get them right away. Mm-hmm. After something like this, because otherwise even though they might send a ransom note or something, that's really just not not going to happen in these kinds of cases where a child is involved.
Yeah, and you were brought in to interview this little girl, you know, and right. I mean she's a living victim, but she's also a child, so you have to conduct that interview in a very different way than if you were, let's say, interviewing, you know, David Berkowitz in you know, in prison, right?
Sure. Yeah, I do child drawings. That's what I had been doing with child victims of sexual abuse. So I said, well, just do the drawings because it gives some structure to the interview. It isn't scary to the child. The parents are there. And she really gave us a lot of good information.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so good. She was
drawing. As well as described her trauma.
So she was drawing with crayons and things?
Yes, I brought crayons and paper.
Now, it turns out, did you ever get to speak with the man who abducted her and ended up killing her friend and two other people, at least two other people?
No, that was Brian Duggan. And I'm not sure the agent went to more local. It was the local group rather than Quantico.
Right.
So, no, I didn't speak with Brian Duggan.
Because
he had quite a history.
He had a big history. And one of the things, you know, he hits a lot of the... He lit a family cat on fire. So if you believe in the triad, you know, he knocks out two with one there. He tried to molest his little brother. He burned down his family's garage. And then he also claimed that he was molested as a teen by John Wayne Gacy. I don't know if you know that or not, but
not sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah.
When you know, who knows if that's true or not? I mean, he is still around, but
it's the same area. It's Illinois, Chicago area.
You know, when you talk about doing the profile, you break it down into four stages. The data collection is the first one, and that's really mainly, you know, crime scene and victimology, the preliminary police report, the neighborhood socioeconomic status, and all that stuff. Then once you've compiled all of that stuff, where do you put it into, or where were you putting it into? Was it just pen and paper before, and then now it goes into computers now? And then what's the next thing after that?
Well, the next thing after, those are the data points that go in. And then there has to be some kind of synthesis of what it means in terms of the suspect that you're trying to profile. Then it has to get tested out. And then, of course, if it's a serial type offender, there has to be more information put into it. And I think the best example of that is the first chapter on Jean Jaubert, because there was the first case. And then there was the second case, and Bob Ressler was doing the profiling, and he changed. It's interesting how he changed after the second victim. He changed some of his information because obviously there was more inputs that came into that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the reason why you decided to lead with Jaubert? And give us a little background about Jaubert, because it was out of Bellevue, Nebraska, I believe. This was the newspaper voice, right?
Yeah. That was an interesting case because they had this first little newsboy. I think he was around 12 years old that disappeared. Again, I think it was on a weekend or a Sunday on this paper route, and they don't find him. They get a massive group missing person kind of thing, but they do find him, and he's only by the roadside. He's kind of like, to use the word, they call the word dumping. The body was just kind of dumped. Then there is nothing. Bob does the profile for it because it was, you can imagine a 12-year-old boy, it really gets the community upset and nervous and frightened. So then in December is the second one. And that was important because it was snowing. And if hunters hadn't found the body, it probably wouldn't have been found for months because this was a cold area. But they saw this body and it was so similar, but it was it moved into the woods. And so that was the way they profiled that is the age and the size of the killer. And why? Because there's two sets of footprints into the woods, but only one set obviously out. And they felt that he couldn't carry the child, that he was smaller, that the killer was going to be small because the boys were probably around 100 pounds. And he didn't do that with the first body, but with the second one, marched him in, assaulted him. He didn't sexually assault either victim, but it was felt it was sexually intended. And that's where we began to get some insights onto why the no apparent motive, that it could be a sexual killing, but yet there would not be any evidence, more traditional evidence found. And that was so true there. So anyway, that Bob changed the profile. They got the information out, and it was a very observant woman teacher who saw this car, and that's how they actually found out who it was. Bob had said he would be an airman from Offutt Air Base, which was near in that area, that he would be probably an E. I think he almost got exactly, he said an E3, I think he was actually an E4. And there was unusual rope. When they got a search warrant, they found the rope. It was something that was made, I think, over in Korea or something. And that really was so important, a finding that it made the congressional record. And that the reason that was important, because we were finally getting some recognition for the work that they had been doing. To get into the congressional record was considered quite good. But we were at Quantico. Bob was giving this case. Afterwards, a detective from Maine came in and said, I think this sounds like one of our unsolved juvenile killings. And sure enough, he had moved to Maine, and then he had gone to college, flunked out of college, and then joined the service. And right. That's how he ended up out in Indiana, whatever it was. Yeah.
In Maine, he had killed 11-year-old Ricky Stetson.
That's right. Ricky Stetson had been killed, but also don't remember two or three other trials that right. He had tried to do. There is always some practice with these cases.
Yeah, I would just add real quick that one of the reasons we wanted to kick off the book with the Joubert case too was that it was so early in profiling. As you guys pointed out, Ressler was willing to look at this profile he'd initially created, to adapt that to new input as it was coming in. And one of the things that, we tried to point out in that part of the book was that for profiling to truly work, it really needed to have buy-in from local law enforcement community. People needed to trust that profiling was a viable process that really could work and get results. But for profiling to really work and get these results, it needed these inputs that only the investigators had. So it was this sort of coming together and trusting each other type of moment. And it was really sort of kicked off the legitimacy to profiling.
Right. And I think, Dr. Burgess, you touched upon something which has been, I would characterize maybe a little bit of a pet peeve. And I've gone on rants on this podcast before, where, like in this particular case, I'm sure pathologists, investigators, had this thought there was no signs of sexual assault. But that does not mean it's not a sexually motivated crime.
That was one of our major findings. So thank you for bringing that up. That really was the, if you remember back then, it was called No Apparent Motive, I think was the actual first video that they did. Yeah.
NAM, you'd see some, in little boxes up in the headers of some of these reports, NAM, No Apparent Motive.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And when I think Ressler went back to have a follow-up interview with Joubert, several years later, and there was mention of having photos of the crime scenes, Joubert got really excited and really wanted to see those photos. And, obviously, what's the motivation on his part there? Yeah. Clearly, he's getting some sort of thrill out of it.
Yep, right.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, and we saw that also with Samuel Little recently when he was drawing the pictures of his victims. He definitely was getting satisfaction out of that. There was no hesitation right there about that. I want to talk about the Taco Bell strangler, Henry Louis Wallace. He was unusual because he was the first Black serial killer that you'd come across, and he knew most of his victims. But Ressler, when he's interviewing him, pulled out True Crime magazines and kind of asked him what he saw. sort of like a Rorschach test. What did you learn from Wallace about what his motivations were, and why was he almost sort of like an outlier?
Well, he was an outlier for a lot of reasons, but in terms of, because basically we couldn't find much juvenile behavior, crime behavior, up until he hit, well, after he's married, he'd been in the Navy, and he hit a whole series of stressors that seemed to bring him down. But on the other hand, he had the fantasies. He was able to tell us about the fantasies that he had as a young boy because of these detective magazines that he used to look at. And his mother had these True Confession. Mm-hmm. Evidently, they also had similar kinds of women and provocative positions, et cetera, much as the detective magazine. So as Bob, he had 15 magazines that he brought out, and he would ask him in each one, what was it that he would focus in on? The other thing he did is he also said, what did you look at in here? Because you could buy all kinds of things in these magazines. You could buy police badges, and you could buy drugs, or not drugs, but certain kinds of things. And Henry just kept talking about how that was an important part of his upbringing, even though he didn't act out in any way or seem to be off track, if you will, until he hit this later time. But there had been a couple of other black serial killers. Carlton Gary was one, the Silk Stocking killer out of, I want to say, one of the southern states. But for some reason, they didn't get that. The only one that had really worked that case was Judd Ray, who was a police officer down there. But back to Henry Wallace, when they finally counted up, he even confessed to more cases that he had done than the police knew about. So from that standpoint, he escalated. That's the other thing that was quite interesting that he did. But the fantasies were the ones that I think were most telling, and the detective magazine were clearly his pornography.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because it's interesting. You know, you've obviously watched true crime explode in popular culture now. What a lot of people don't realize is that true crime, you know, they had the detective magazines up until like the 1960s. They focused on the crimes. They were a little bit lurid, but once the 70s hit, you see what happens, and it's all half naked women on the cover being murdered, basically. And they basically acted as pornography, like you were saying, for people. And if somebody left it around the house, it was different than the stigma of maybe leaving around a Playboy around the house. Cause it's like, no, I'm into these crimes. And they were, if you look at the inside of the magazines, the ads, they obviously were gearing towards men. There was like things for like Charles Atlas type stuff, like how to get a better body as a man, the fake police badges, the lifts in your shoes, like all of these things that were in the backs of those magazines. So what is your, you know, as you've seen this, you know, pop culture and serial killers, you know, is something that we fight against a lot, you know, people saying certain things about serial killers. And what do you think movies like Silence of the Lambs get wrong when making these stories into entertainment?
Well, there are going to be people that it strikes a chord with them, if you will, in terms of the sexual intent. Others can, people can look at it and just say, well, that's, you know, that pass it by. But for Henry Wallace, he was fascinated with the bondage. That's what he focused on, the tying up, the wrapping, all of that. And so with his victims, he would strangle them so that the tying up, bondage, if you will, is what he said. And that's exactly what he did with his victims, because the crime scenes were all quite similar. If you want to look at it from that standpoint, he certainly varied, and some tried to cover it up. And in one with his victim, Juniper, he set the stove on fire, and so the apartment burned, and even the fireman didn't realize that it was a homicide.
Right.
So he confessed to that. Yeah. It was one. There were two that he confessed to that the police did not know. So he was able to cover up things. He got no surprise that as they do more and more, they get, if you will, better and better at avoiding arrest. What I think was one of his downfalls is he was very heavy into drugs by the end of his killing.
Right.
He did three like in 2 days. I mean, they're just one right after another.
Yeah.
He just couldn't stop. And he's very open about that. He couldn't stop.
You know, and I had a mentor, if you will, a professional friend mentor, California DOJ profiler, Sharon Pageling. And, you know, one of the things that she taught me was you need to know what is feeding the offender's fantasies, you know, and she back in the day, you know, when I was and I know her to this day, but, you know, when I first met her back in the 1990s, you know, she was going into the adult bookstores, you know, to see what was available. And of course, now there's a lot online on the internet. But, you know, when we get to start taking a look at something like the popular movie Silence of the Lambs or the True Detective type magazines, Dr. Park Dietz had an article, you know, that basically it's porn for the sexual sadist. And it's one of those things where that's so important. And I know when I talk to law enforcement now, I basically, you know, have a class on the introduction and recognition of the serial predator. And basically the fundamental basis of this is know thy enemy. And in order to do that, you have to see what's feeding their fantasies because they're going to want to live those fantasies out. And so that's where I think, you know, what you guys did, you know, at the FBI is really just that foundation for building upon, you know, where we are at today. But we still have so far to go because most law enforcement never deals with the serial predator, never deals with the fantasy motivated predator, you know, so we have to continue to get that message out. And that's where you putting a book out is just tremendous for my perspective, because not only it's not necessarily an academic study, but for me, it's going to be like a textbook that I will use, but other investigators need to read because of your expertise and what you have experienced over your decades of researching these types of offenders.
So, Dr. Burgess, by the time this episode is going to be released, the book will be out. And, you know, one thing which would be great is, you know, we have so many people asking us, how can I get into this line of work? You know, they ask me, I want to be an investigative journalist. I tell them, you're going to be in for a lot of heartache, especially now. You know, I was at least able to get in under the, like, right before newspapers went away. But what would you tell people that, because we get emails all the time about saying, you know, I want to break into this line of work. What can I do? Where do I start?
Well, probably Stephen's a better one to answer that of how did we get together to write a book? Because I thought about it for a long time, but never had done anything about it until Stephen came along at the School of Nursing and, really kind of, I don't know, Stephen, you want to add your 2 cents to that?
Oh yeah, sure. So it was, it was really just sort of a coincidence of timing. At Boston College, where Dr. Burgess and I both work, we had a big event soon after the first season of Mindhunter came out, where we had John Douglas come onto campus, and we set up a conversation between him and Dr. Burgess to talk about Mindhunter, what was accurate, you know, what was maybe, as Dr. Burgess might say, a little Hollywood, stretch the truth a little bit. And then they talked about, you know, behind the scenes type of stuff and how it all really worked. And the more I helped in setting up that event, the more I heard Dr. Burgess's story, which, you know, I don't think it ever really been told before. A lot of people didn't know. She didn't really like the spotlight. She was more interested in using what she'd learned to teach students for more practical purposes. But it just seemed like there was a lot of value in getting her story out. So the more we talked about it, the more she opened up to the idea. And so we just sat down, wrote a few test chapters, and it really just worked very well because as an academic, Dr. Burgess has a huge archive of all sorts of saved materials, transcripts of profiling sessions, you know, recorded interviews with killers, and just all sorts of fantastic stuff. So it made the writing process really easy. And then as an academic also, she's able to explain really difficult, challenging concepts in really easy terms, which was valuable for me in helping write the book and valuable for her writing the book as well. It just opens it up to really accessible material and makes it easy for an audience to consume too, I think.
Excellent. Okay. And Dr. Burgess, what about somebody that wants to become a profiler?
Well, actually, John Douglas has written a book on what to do if you want to become a profiler. That's where he puts puts some emphasis in, he puts a lot of emphasis in on experience, on getting some good, what we would call a clinical experience in nursing, but he calls it a certainly investigative experience, so that there is something to draw on, that they, that the person has a base for that. If you're going to do a team approach, in other words, you're going to have the journalist and then the whoever is doing the investigation. So I think that helps to start the process. And then you have to have it also provides the content, the cases. You got to have content. Although I guess you can do some discussion of cases that are, I was just thinking and, when you made the comment about the serial aspect of some of these offenders, we just had that awful case out in where the 15-year-old had taken a gun to school and shot classmates. What I found most interesting in his comments were when he did the drawing of the gun and the person and shooting, and he said, "I can't get these thoughts. I can't stop the thoughts. Help." And that's exactly what is going on in the heads of these killers, is that they get it in the head and they are really tortured by it. And so I think from a, if you want to look at prevention, we've got to be able to access that kind of trouble, if you will, in young people earlier than we are.
Yes. Well, you know, and I think, you know, that was important because you had indicated that, you know, two killers that seemed to be outliers, Monty Rissell and Ed Kemper, you know, where you thought that they actually demonstrated a level of empathy. And, you know, that's struck a chord because I saw as I was going through the Golden State Killer cases that the offender in that case seemed to have a level of empathy. You know, so now it comes down to a question. Everybody just assumes that somebody who's a serial predator is a psychopath. What is your opinion?
No, I don't buy that. I mean, certainly some are, but I think that whole issue of empathy, I know, Henry Wallace at his trial gave a very moving, I felt very honest, empathetic point to the families, specifically to talk to the families and saying there was nothing that your daughters or your sisters or whomever did. I was the one that did it. And he was very sorry. And he went on and on. And that I think is what put him somewhat apart. Also on Monty Rissell, he let one of the victims go, especially when she started talking about her father having cancer and his brother had a bout with cancer. And so that struck a chord with him and he let her go. Yeah. So those are some points that if you can, you know, if a victim can think fast enough of what could she say that might save her. We always try to put that in. I always, in any of my discussion on cases, I would always try to say what would make a difference.
Yeah.
And it is what you can say or what you do.
Yeah.
So that you don't escalate the rage and the anger that these men have.
Sure. And it's not to diminish, you know, the atrocities of their crimes, but it definitely from a psychology standpoint, I mean, they're much more complicated than just painting them as these, you know, these monsters that have no empathy. There's more going on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I went to Boston University. We did not play BC in the bean pot because there was no bean pot this year. But next year we will take the bean pot home. I really miss those college hockey games. But thank you so much. Where can people find you? And are you on social media or anything like that? Where could they find the book?
Stephen, you have that information. We're both at Boston College, but there is a website, right, Stephen?
Yeah, killerbydesign.com is a website for the book. You can check that out. Dr. Burgess is not on social media, so you'll just have to get her insights directly from the book itself.
Yeah, that's right. Just buy the book. Pay up. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Everybody, thank you so much for joining us for this Winter Distraction. We'll have another one coming at you next week. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Follow us on social media because we do have social media accounts. And until then, keep digging.
Yeah, keep digging. And such a pleasure, Dr. Burgess and Stephen. Thank you so much.
Enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting us.
Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions.
Senior producer, Pauly Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgariff, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.